and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at noon and Friday at 6 o'clock. Real Talk is the show that explores questions large and small, and there don't seem to be any small ones anymore. Today is very exciting for me. I want to say that in today's polarized atmosphere, many blame our troubles on the warlike and dominant nature of humans. However, my guest today is among a group of social and system scientists who studied human origins and found that our true nature leans toward compassion, collaboration, and partnership. She is Rian Eisler, author of The Chalice and the Blade, written in 1987, The Real Wealth of Nations, and now, with Dr. Doug Fry, Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Brains, Lives, and Future. Welcome back to Real Talk, Rian.
Pleasure to be with you, Susan.
It is so wonderful to have you, and as I've told friends here on the island that you were going to be on the show, they were all jealous that I get to talk with you, and all mentioned that a couple of folks are educators and say that they've been using the chalice and the blade in their teachings for years.
So, that's lovely. I don't know who all is using it, so it's always good to hear. And yeah, that book is now in its 57th U.S. printing, and I, on its 30th anniversary, I wrote a new epilogue, which brings it up to date. So for people who get the book, I really urge you to get the last printing, which will have the epilogue, which, of course, brings it up to now, including Mr. Trump.
Oh, boy. I need to tell our listeners that you are listening to the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP Vashon Island, Washington, your island connection. And we can do this thanks to the generosity of Windermere Vashon Real Estate. They support all our community information programming, and they make our emergency alert service possible. You can find them on the web at windermerevashon.com. So, Rian Eisler, your new book, Nurturing Our Humanity, explores so many aspects of human nature, from biology to ideology, social evolution to love, and its impact on the brain. As I've been going through your book, I really think the opening paragraphs summarize the goal of your research for the book. Would you be willing to read those first three paragraphs from our story?
Well, I will have to get the book, so why don't you read it?
Okay, I will read it.
If you have it in front of you, I didn't realize I was supposed to be prepared.
Sorry. I threw you a curve. Okay. It opens by saying, "For millennia, humans have imagined a peaceful and just world. Sometimes we only imagined this world in an afterlife. But over the last centuries, many of us have imagined it right here on Earth. Not a utopia, not a perfect world, but a world where peace is more than just an interval between wars, where dire poverty, brutal oppression, insensitivity, cruelty, and despair are no longer just the way things are. Now there is a new urgency to our wish for a humane world. Every day we are bombarded by news of barbaric human rights abuses, terrorist attacks, proliferation of nuclear weapons, and a drift back to strongman rule. The destruction of our natural environment continues at an accelerating pace, endangering our global life support systems. New technologies from artificial intelligence to biological engineering could have catastrophic results if guided by cultural values of greed, megalomania, and disregard for human rights. From all sectors, religious and secular, philosophical and scientific, and thousands of small groups worldwide, come calls for cultural transformation, for building a truly humane culture. The pivotal question is whether such a culture, one that supports rather than inhibits human well-being and our capacities to love, create, and prosper, is possible." Whew.
Yes. that's quite an opening, I admit. But that's where we are, isn't it? And as you know, Susan, my research and writing and speaking and organizing over now close to four decades has focused on answering that question. Which is a resounding yes, by the way. We can build this world, but also on really showing that to do this, well, as Einstein said, you can't solve problems with the same thinking that created them. to help us think in different ways and to focus on interventions that are foundational so that we don't keep having these regressions.
Well, like, you and your co-author, Doug Fry, really used a new analytical tool to look at human nature from a completely different perspective and delve into the possibilities and the capacities that we have for creating a more humane society. You called it the biocultural partnership domination lens. Can you tell us about that?
I wish it weren't so long and and kind of nerdy sounding, but it's very descriptive, actually, of what we need to do. First of all, in this book, we look at the very false argument about nature versus nurture. The reality, as the new field of bioculturalism is proving again and again and again, is that the two are inextricably interconnected. We know that the issue really is gene expression, not genes, and that heavily depends on, the kind of environment, and for humans it's mostly the cultural environment that we are in. And that takes me to the second part, which is the partnership domination lens. What I found in my research and what this book uses as a lens is really a very different, much more holistic, integrated way of looking at human societies that, unlike conventional studies as well as conventional social categories like right-left, religious-secular, Eastern-Western, Northern-Southern, actually no longer excludes or marginalizes the majority of humanity, women and children. And that's huge, by the way.
That to me was almost shocking, and it's curious to me as to why that was shocking. It's so obvious, and yet has so clearly impacted all our cultural development as humans.
Well, you know, it's like fish in water, isn't it? We've been brought up to... I was brought up that way. I mean, it wasn't really until the women's liberation movement that I realized, wow, you know, in all my years of so-called higher education, there was hardly anything about, by, or for people like me, women. And as for children, you know, how much do we really learn about children in our educational system? So little, and even child development, which we have now so much documentation about, not only from psychology, but from neuroscience, is still siloed, taught only in the context of family, in the context of, what kind of development you see. It should be part of sociology. It should be part of political science. It should be part of economics. And that's what this work does.
Yes. And as I read, the question came to mind, and I think our listeners would like to hear this in greater depth. How do our cultural traditions of child rearing, family structure, religion, and even sexuality connect to shape a society? You mentioned, I think, it becomes part of our DNA.
Well, you know, the cultural DNA is really what we can change. And the cultural DNA that we have inherited, as I mentioned, I mean, consider that for you know, the so-called modern science came out of the Middle Ages, right? You know, over 1,000 years. Only in the last 50 years did gender studies, starting with women's studies and then men's studies, gender studies, queer studies, etc., even enter the academy, and it's still marginalized. We've been taught such a crazy picture of what's important for us as humans. When we know today from neuroscience that how our brains develop, because we're very large brain species, and we are helpless, almost totally helpless, for so much of our early years, depending on nurture, on care by others. And so it is during those years that our brains actually develop. We're not born with fully developed brains. So we have to pay a lot of attention, not only for personal issue, you know, reasons, or for family reasons, but for the kind of world we live in, to how children are raised. And the studies that we have today, which are reported, of course, in this book, like the Adverse Childhood Experiences Longitudinal Study done right here, the ACE studies, show that trauma is really integral to so much of so-called child rearing, even in the United States.
And that was fascinating to me. In the United States, as you were, I think, about to say, domination is the rule.
Well, it is and it isn't. And this is why I think once we change the lens and get away from these old categories, you know, right, left, I mean, my God, think about it. There have been oppressive and violent regimes, you know, whether it was Hitler's Germany or Stalin's Soviet Union, in every one of our cultural categories, you know, whether they're religious or secular, Eastern or Western. Once we start thinking that the real struggle for our future is between the configuration of a domination system at one end of the scale and a partnership system on the other end, then we see that actually we have been moving towards partnership again. And I say again because, as you know, some of what's in this book, as well as in some of my earlier books, shows that the original direction of human culture was more in a partnership direction. And over the last centuries, in the wake of the disequilibrium, really, of the Industrial Revolution, which took centuries, we've challenged one tradition of domination after another, from the so-called divinely ordained right of kings to rule, to, you know, the so-called divinely ordained right of men to rule over women and children, the so-called divinely ordained rule, challenged by the abolitionist movement, civil rights, anti-colonial movements of, quote, superior race to rule over inferior ones, all the way to the environmental movement challenging our once hallowed conquest of nature, which could do us in if guided by an ethos of domination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you keep saying divinely. It starts to sound like the idea of divine is part of the problem.
Yes, but then you got social biology and the selfish gene, for which there is absolutely no basis whatsoever. Darwin, my husband, David Loy, has written extensively about what he calls Darwin's lost theory. Darwin, in the book that he wrote called Descent of Man, about human evolution, apologized for using the term survival of the fittest in that book, and said at the human level other dynamics come into play than just natural selection. And yet Darwin is, as David Loy puts it, my husband, that 800-pound gorilla, right?
Yes.
That people trot out, and they trot out the selfish genes. And you know, you have to wonder sometimes why there is this battle between, religion and science, when so much of science has been hijacked, really, the selfish gene or original sin, it's the same story, isn't it?
Yes. And your chapter on love and evolution kind of applies the idea that the emergence of love to survival of the species is more powerful than the idea of Darwin's survival of the fittest.
You know, and it really wasn't Darwin's part of the way survival of the fittest. He got it from Spencer, who was the favorite during the last time that the gap between haves and have-nots was so wide. At the time that Darwin wrote, who was a favorite of the tycoons, of that age, because it's so easy to use it to justify domination, violence, and justice, right?
Uh-huh. Well, tell us then how love has shaped our capacities for intelligence and symbolic thinking, and learning, communication, all those things you mentioned, planning, creativity, and choice. How has love shaped us, and not necessarily the survival of the fittest or the 800-pound gorilla?
Well, I will start with giving you again a little background. The study of love in science is very recent. It's only as we have started to move more towards the partnership side that this so-called soft, feminine, we have a gendered system of values, mm-hmm. right, has been considered worthy of scientific study. And in this book, we introduce the idea that you just mentioned, which is that actually, were it not for the evolution of caring and love, which has a long history, mammals and birds, and then, of course, with humans, it takes a leap. Were it not for that, we wouldn't be here for the reason that I just briefly mentioned, which is that we are not born with fully developed brains. Mm-hmm. And for humans to survive requires at least some degree of caring. And we know also, and this is really very tragic, that when young children do not get any love, like the orphans in Romanian orphanages, or the little girls who were in China, put in orphanages because of the male preference, their brains do not properly develop. So, and some of them die.
Horrifying.
Lack of love. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a question of survival, but it's a question of developing, as you said, the enormous capacities inherent in humans, the enormous capacity for caring, for consciousness, and for creativity.
Well, in your research, what evidence did you find that contradicts the notion that humans are innately violent, greedy, and selfish, and really supports the notion that we have thrived because of love? What was your specific evidence?
There was so much evidence of it, and we really don't pay attention to it, frankly, because we are totally always bombarded by this, selfish genes, original sin, we're bad, and that's just human nature.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I'll give you two experiments. One is an experiment where people have the choice to either share or to win. And the pleasure centers of our brains light up more when people choose sharing than winning.
Oh, that's good news.
Yes, it is good news.
That
and there are many experiments, by the way, showing, the obvious, that actually giving and caring makes us feel good. Loving, not just being loved, but loving gives us endorphins, doesn't it? But there was another experiment I just wanted to share quickly, which was very fascinating because it was done by a scientist at the Max Planck Institute, and he wanted to see how toddlers would react to someone who was so-called accidentally dropping books or clothes that he was trying to hang. And what he found is fascinating, that when he actually threw a book down, these toddlers did nothing. But if it seemed as if he were accidentally dropping it, they would toddle over to try to pick it up to help him. So the desire to help is really built into us, isn't it? But, and this is a big but, if we live in domination environments, that is basically inhibited, and not only inhibited, but the opposite, violence, domination, cruelty are presented to us as the only alternatives, as normal.
And that seems to be the culture that the Western world is living in, the culture of domination. But you talk in your book a great deal about the fact that you see us moving more toward a culture of partnership. Could you give us a brief comparison of those two? What are the components of a culture of domination versus the components of a culture of partnership?
Well, let me focus on some societies, whether they are tribal, like the Terurai, or agrarian, like the Minangkabau, or industrial and post-industrial, like Sweden, Finland, Norway. Those societies have moved more to the partnership side of the social scale. In comparison, and there are some core components. First is that in contrast to domination systems, you know, whether it's Hitler's Nazi Germany or Kim Jong-un's North Korea or ISIS, there is more democracy in these families and in the society at large in all of these more partnership-oriented societies.
Hmm.
Secondly, the rankings of domination, you know, man over man over woman, race over race, religion over religion, etc., are ultimately held together by fear and force. So the Nordic nations have been in the forefront of working to leave behind traditions of domination and violence we inherited. It's not coincidental that the first peace studies came out of Sweden. It's not coincidental that the first laws, this is very important, laws that make it illegal to use physical discipline against children came out of those nations. And by the way, the American Psychological Association finally came out and said not only is spanking ineffective, but it is harmful to child development. So that's the second core component. And the third, and this is vital, these are societies where there is much more equal partnership between the male and female halves of humanity. You know, we have two forms in our species, male and female.
Mm-hmm.
In domination systems, that difference is equated with dominating or being dominated, with superiority or inferiority, with being served or serving. In these nations, there is much more, as I said, gender equity. So much so, now they're not perfect, but so much mm-hmm. so that about 50% of the national legislature is female. And what happens then, as the status of women rises, men no longer feel so threatened in their status and their, quote, masculinity, you know, and today we call it toxic masculinity,
mm-hmm.
To embrace more stereotypically feminine soft policies and values. So these nations, which were so poor at the beginning of the last century that there were famines, they instituted caring policies, universal health care, universal child care that's accessible and very good quality, very generous paid parental leave, elder care with dignity, and also it goes with it, they've been much more caring for our natural environment. These are policies that made it possible for these nations to now appear regularly in the top ranks of the World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Reports, as well as the World Happiness Reports. And by the way, I really want to make two qualifications. One, they're not socialists. Mm-hmm. They have a very healthy market economy. They call themselves often caring societies. And two, they didn't move this way because they're small and relatively homogeneous. There are plenty of relatively small homogeneous societies that orient to domination all the way through. We've got to start thinking differently. It's because they moved to the partnership side.
And I'm curious, in your description of the Nordic societies, especially since you said they were so poor not that long ago, which came first, the values or the legislation?
You know, what came first is more complicated. I can speak about Finland because I have a very good friend who's Finnish, and so I know their history through her from on a personal level. They had a very strong women's movement very early, and the women in that movement went into the countryside to educate women. And that empowered women. And, the rest is history.
You know, we haven't talked a lot about the domination culture and the components thereof, and we've only got 3 minutes left, but in your book, you explain in considerable detail how the domination systems in which most of us now live have held back humanity. We're talking today during the week after mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton, Ohio. Have we gone too far? How do we change our course?
Well, of course we can change our course, and the Nurturing Our Humanity ends with four core interventions: changing childhood patterns of abuse and violence, empowering women, changing our economic system to a caring economics that values the work of caring for people and nature, and stories, narratives. And I want to say something. Yes, we have inherited domination culture, but we're not purely a domination culture in this country. Look at the reaction you are having, and mm-hmm. so many people have. That's because we have moved to the partnership side and say, no, we won't. We really don't have to have this, and we are going to change it.
How do we go about doing that?
Well, those four interventions mm-hmm. is the way. And by the way, there are no quick fixes. You know, if you just put on a Band-Aid with the stroke of a pen, it's off. These are long-term. But look, it's happening. Look at the Me Too movement. Look at the movement of men to change gender socialization for men. Look at the ACE studies showing, hey, we've got to change the way that children are brought up. Look at economics. I just spoke at the Bretton Woods 75 anniversary conference on developing a new social wealth economic index that shows the enormous economic value of the work of caring for people and nature. It's in process, but we do need to understand, as I said before, that the major movement is the issue of moving away from domination systems to partnership systems, and that requires attention to these hitherto ignored matters, it seems so obvious that you should pay attention to gender and childhood.
Thank you, Rion Eisler. I can't thank you enough for joining us. You've been listening to Real Talk. My guest has been Rion Eisler, author of, most recently, Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Brains, Lives, and Future. Rion, where can we get this book?
Oh, you can. I will email you. You can get it at Amazon, of course, but you can also get it at a 30% discount directly from Oxford University Press.
Excellent.
And if you like, I will send you the... Well, just go to Oxford University Press and put in Nurturing Our Humanity, and it'll take you to the discount.
Excellent. Rhian, of course, there's always more to talk about. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us on Real Talk. And listeners, thank you for joining us as well.
And thank you, Susan. It's been a pleasure.
This has been Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe. Happy to be here with you every Tuesday at noon and Friday at 6 p.m. Stay tuned. You never know what you're going to get next on The Voice of Vashon.